Hello, this is episode number 18 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, June 21st, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. We have several interesting issues up for discussion this week. First, I'll talk a little bit about my new book on parental controls. Second, Congress debating an immigration proposal that would require a beefed-up national ID system. And third, Google is beefing up its presence in Washington, D.C. Joining me to discuss these topics today are Technology Liberation Front contributors Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
Jim Harper of the Cato Institute. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Adam.
Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute. Hello, Hans.
Hey, Adam.
And our special guest this week is Cord Bloomquist of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hi, Cord.
Hey, Adam.
Well, first up this week, I wanted to briefly mention the fact that I've got a new book out. This new book is entitled Parental Controls and Online Child Protection, A Survey of Tools and Methods. I put this book together over the past year and a half or 2 years to basically give policymakers, the public, and parents a really clear understanding of all the alternative means they have to go about protecting their children from what they would regard as potentially objectionable content or communications or contacts online. And, of course, my belief is that we should always yield to those sorts of solutions instead of asking government to regulate. But I wanted to go out and survey everything on the market to actually show people that those alternatives were there, were realistic, and were effective. And so the result is a roughly 120-page book that is online at the pff.org site at pff.org/parental controls and can be freely downloaded by anyone. The report is also unique in that it will be constantly updated online as I get new information about everything that's on the market in terms of parental controls and online child protection methods and efforts. And so it starts off with version 2.0, but I already have version 2.1 in the works coming up next month. Basically, in the book, I go through just not only all the technical controls that are on the market for all the various media sectors and technologies, from television, movies, to music and radio, video games, wireless and mobile media, and, of course, internet and social networking, but I also talk a lot about informal household rules as being an important part of the story that policymakers in particular always forget or just ignore. What I mean by that is the fact that all parents, all homes, surveys have shown, have rules about how their kids will consume media. We all grew up with rules like, you can't watch any TV until you get your homework done, or no playing games after 8 o'clock at night, or whatever. And those sorts of rules are actually far more effective and important than technical controls like the V-chip or filters or anything else. Basically, it's good old-fashioned parental responsibility. I also talk a lot in the book about the importance of education and media literacy and the idea of teaching kids to be savvy about what they're seeing or hearing in media, to know when they are basically being sold something or being told something that is silly or fictitious. So these are, again, part of just sensible parenting, but that's also where schools and other educators can have a role. And then finally, my book wraps up with a few other things about online child safety, debunking myths about social networking and the fears that are out there about social networking, and talking about how to improve that situation where legitimate concerns exist. So that's a brief overview of the book.
So, Adam, I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but it sounds, am I right that it's more looking at technology and social practices rather than being primarily a policy book?
Well, that's right. It is mostly, as the subtitle implies, a survey of tools and methods, everything that's on the market. But I start the book off with very much a policy discussion about how parental controls fit into current policy discussions about media and technology law. And, of course, every single debate these days about the internet or television or games, you always hear that phrase, it's about the children. And, of course, you know, hey, I'm a father of two kids. I care about kids. I care about my own kids in particular. And I believe that parental responsibility is always the first and best way to approach concerns about kids. But I wanted to make sure that people were aware of the fact that many, many tools exist to help parents get that job done. And that has a major influence on law in this country. And for the last 10 years, as you guys know, the internet cases that have been coming down and the video game cases, we've been winning really strong First Amendment decisions there because the courts have said consistently, if there is a quote-unquote less restrictive means of dealing with this other than government regulation, then government has to yield to that less restrictive means. What are less restrictive means? Well, they're parental controls and things like filters and V-chips and set-top box controls and ratings. And so I said, I'm going to survey everything out there, just make sure people understand it's there, and show also policymakers in the courts that, look, you can't regulate, you can't censor when parents have these tools at their disposal and have been empowered to make the decisions for themselves.
So are these tools easy enough to use, do you think? I mean, are parents, and parents might be a little bit intimidated by a 120-page book they have to read in order to protect their children. Are there particular tools that are particularly convenient for parents?
Well, that's an excellent question, Tim, and I get that question a lot when I'm debating other people or talking to members of Congress. And I'm going to be, in fact, testifying at a hearing tomorrow in the House Energy and Commerce Committee called The Images Kids See on the Screen, which is all about concerns about what kids can see on various types of screens. And so what I'm hoping to show in the book is that these tools are actually very easy to use. They're not that difficult. And so I believe that most parents can get it if they try. The problem is a lot of parents don't try. And it's something that's uncomfortable to talk about in this debate, but let's face it, there's a little bit of parental laziness here. Some of it's driven by an ignorance of the technology. It means sometimes you have the flashing VCR clock idea problem. You know, some parents just don't want to take the steps. But the reality is most of these tools are very easy to use if you just take a few minutes to learn.
But, you know, let's not get totally caught up in that because, you know, when policymakers debate tax policy, military policy, or whatever else you care to name, I mean, they don't sit around worrying about the competence of ordinary adults to read instructions and comply, you know, with procedures. And it's only in this context that we seem to be concerned about the competence of ordinary adults to read what really are simple instructions, and I don't mean to be pejorative, but operate devices requiring something less than ordinary skill and competence. They can call their cable company, can't they, and ask for assistance over the phone if they want to.
Exactly. You could call any company, basically, and the companies, in most cases, make it very easy for consumers and parents to use these tools. In many cases, by the way, most of these parental control tools I talk about in the book are free of charge. I mean, every ISP you subscribe to now offers you free security tools that you can download, which include parental controls. It's just a matter of clicking a few buttons and setting up a few things and toggling a few switches on instead of off. Another good example, I mean, people don't realize what a powerful tool Google and Yahoo and Microsoft have created with their safe search technologies. If you turn your preferences to put safe search on, you'll be amazed by how much stuff actually gets blocked. And so you can create a profile for your kid on your computer, turn on your safe search tools, put on your operating system controls, as both Apple and Microsoft have excellent controls now, and add a filter. And you're going to get 95 to 99% of probably you what you want to stop from seeing your young kids seeing. And from there, you can use other tools, monitoring software or whatever else, to see what else your kid's up to. So, you're absolutely right, Hans. I mean, part of this is people don't want to say, hey, parents, get on the ball, deal with your kids. Well, anyway, why don't we move on to our next issue so we don't spend too much time me tooting my own horn about my book. But let's turn to Congress debating an immigration proposal that would require a beefed-up national ID system. And to do so, I'm going to turn to our TLF colleague, Jim Harper. Jim, tell us what's going on.
Thanks, Adam. You know, for a while there, it was looking like Real ID, the national ID law, was on the ropes, and it still is on the ropes. But the Department of Homeland Security and some folks in Congress are doing their best to revive it. Not yet debated in the immigration debate that we've seen come and go over the last couple of weeks has been Title III of the bill, which includes rules that essentially boil down to a requirement that everybody have a real ID by 2013 in order to get a job. Title III of the bill is the internal enforcement, the domestic enforcement that is most familiar to us is the Form I-9 process. We have to show your driver's license and a Social Security card when you get hired. They're trying to automate that. They're trying to make it into a system that will share information about our employment with the federal government online, leading to the creation of huge new databases and requiring federal approval for getting hired. It's all an Orwellian and Kafkaesque nightmare, and there's lots of data errors and things like that that are going to come through. But the thing that's most concerning to me, of course, is that Real ID would be required in order to get federal approval for working starting in 2013. If you ever thought there was going to be mission creep once there was a national ID in this country, well, it's already well underway, and that's what's going on in the immigration bill. There is an amendment to strip out the Real ID requirement issue offered by Senator Tester from Montana and Senator Leahy from Vermont. That'll come up. I think the bill is coming up again for debate Friday, and we'll probably consume time in the Senate next week. Of course, it has to go to the House after that if it gets through the Senate. But Real ID is on the ropes, with 17 states rejecting it. South Carolina was the most recent. Governor Mark Sanford signed legislation to refuse one of five states outright, making it contrary to their law to carry out Real ID. The other states, 12 states, have issued objections to Real ID and indicated that they wouldn't want to comply. But that's the latest with immigration law reform. If we get the whole bill as we have it right now, we would end up with a strengthened run at the national ID, although I don't think Real ID can practically be implemented even by 2013.
So then what would happen if this legislation passed and some of the states didn't implement Real ID? Would that mean nobody in one of those states would be allowed to work?
Well, yes, literally, according to the terms of the law, that's what would happen. Of course, they would come up with various extemporaneous rules to try to coax the states into complying. The major sticking point remains to be money. $17 billion is the estimated cost of implementing Real ID, according to the Department of Homeland Security's own cost-benefit analysis. Currently, Congress is batting around the idea of putting forth $300 million for that purpose, which is just a drop in the bucket for implementing. So money will still be a sticking point. And you ain't seen nothing yet until American citizens are jumping over the counters at departments of motor vehicles asking the bureaucrats there who the hell they think they are, requiring them to prove that they're lawfully in the United States and asking for all kinds of documentation so that they can throw it into databases, which will be available nationwide. This is a train wreck that's rolling out very slowly, and I think it'll continue to fail, but it'll fail for years and years and years more rather than just going dark if the immigration bill with the Real ID provisions passed as is.
Is funding the main opposition to this? Is that why people – I mean, is there any states really knocking it just solely based on privacy?
Well, I think funding has been the catalyst for the discussion, because the states looking at their obligations realize how enormous they are, and then they use the privacy – the genuine privacy concerns to strengthen their arguments. It has been, as a practical matter, most state leaders haven't focused until they realized what kind of expense they're facing, and then they looked at the expense, they looked at the privacy consequences, and frankly, they looked at the security benefits. And that's very important, of course, the security benefits of Real ID. The best expression of Real ID's failure in that respect was put forward by the director of the Bureau of Homeland Security in Idaho, who at a meeting I attended said, "I don't believe in the Lone Ranger, I don't believe in the Easter Bunny, and I don't believe in Santa Claus, so I don't believe in silver bullets. And Real ID is claimed to be a silver bullet. It wouldn't work." He had the best understanding of how identification works as a security tool, and knows well that it wouldn't protect us against terrorists. It wouldn't provide substantial resistance to illegal immigration. Illegal immigration has to be fixed on the merits, of course. Congress has to put our immigration law back in line with our economic demand for inexpensive labor and the desire of people outside this country to come here and work.
So, Jim, is there some other way that Congress or the federal government more generally could accomplish the goal of making it impossible for illegal immigrants to get a job? Is there some other identification or other scheme that needs to be put in place, or is that simply an impossible goal that we should stop attempting to accomplish?
Well, I think through this immigration debate and perhaps through what law may be passed, we're going to continue to learn that internal enforcement of immigration law is a mistaken path. In 1996, we started with the basic pilot program, which is the electronic verification, carrying out a 1986 law, which started the I-9 process. All this designed to reduce the economic magnet of work in the United States by making it harder to get work here. But economic forces are very powerful and very difficult to reverse or repeal. And as long as we Americans like to eat in restaurants and live in homes with nice gardens and nice roofs, there's going to be a strong economic demand for that labor. It's going to come, and unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, ID systems that you throw up in front of that are going to be defeated. And if you use this ID system to try and control illegal immigration, they'll break it down. And then, of course, the ID system won't work at all against terrorism and the genuine threats that face the country. So we need to get just away from the idea of internal enforcement. The because it leads inevitably to tracking of all Americans and databases of information about us in the hands of the federal governments, subject to all kinds of security risks. It's just a mistaken policy, and we should move away from it as quickly as possible.
Okay, well, thanks, Jim. We're going to turn to our third issue now, which is Google beefing up its presence here in Washington, D.C. in terms of its lobbying efforts and its lobbying shop. Cord Bloomquist of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, tell us a little bit about what's going on there and why it's a cause for concern.
Well, we saw last week that Google's filed a complaint against Microsoft because of their new desktop search in Vista, which I view as an improvement, but Google views as an affront to competition. But Google's not going to make the same mistake that Microsoft made when it was basically caught with its pants down in 98 with nobody in Washington. The Post reported today on how Google has stepped up their presence, and it seems like Google is not going to be supporting a free market game like Microsoft was prior to 98, and instead they're going to come into Washington with antitrust cases and whatever else they can get their hands on. They're lobbying pretty actively for all sorts of net neutrality things. I know that they're advocating wireless net neutrality now. So I think the concern is that, especially with this specific case of Google desktop search, is that an antitrust case or a decision in favor of Google, which now Microsoft's essentially acquiesced to their demands, means that we're enshrining operating system flaws like the horrible search in Windows XP and prior versions of Windows. We're saying, well, these flaws now just have to be permanent because somebody came in to provide sort of a temporary fix, and now those temporary fixes are protected by antitrust regulation, and that's unfortunate because I think forcing consumers or having consumers install all of these applications separately is certainly an inconvenience, and we've seen integration like this in the past with, I mean, desktop or disk defragmentation didn't used to be built into operating systems, but now it's standard with everything, and I think it's better to have these kind of integrations than than force consumers to install things separately, which is essentially what Google wants them to do.
So there was a development on this front today or yesterday, wasn't there? Did Microsoft announce that they're going to comply with some of these demands?
Yeah, I haven't read the specifics on it, but I imagine what they are going to do to comply is make it possible for the Windows Vista built-in search utility, which essentially does the same smart indexing rather than dumb searching like it did in Windows XP. It's going to make that feature turn-offable, able to turn off, so that now Google Desktop won't be a redundant process running in the background, and if you have like two of these indexers competing, it slows down your system pretty considerably. So I think that's how they're going to acquiesce. I don't see how else they can make Windows Vista search not harmful to Google Desktop's viability in Windows Vista.
So just to play devil's advocate, isn't there an argument that that's good for consumers, that that consumers now will get to choose whether they want to use Google Desktop Search or the built-in Vista Search for their search functionality?
Well, see, I really like the approach that Google was taking before, and I think that not having this this decision or not having Microsoft back down in this case would be better. I mean, Google was saying, why even search in the desktop anymore? Let's move everything onto the Internet. There's numerous other benefits to that. You can access your documents anywhere. It makes you less operating system dependent because a browser works on an Apple computer, a Linux box, anything. And it seems like now Google is just investing in a throwback through this antitrust case, because it seems to me like desktop search is slowly becoming an anachronism. Why are we holding on to these odd technologies of the past when Google has a terrific model for defeating Microsoft on all sorts of other fronts? If it continues pushing things onto the web, it'll also compete with Microsoft as an office company. So I think ultimately this just enshrines an old technology.
I look at these tech companies who build great products and then come to Washington through a sort of public choice light. Having been a tech lobbyist myself for a few years after I left Capitol Hill, it's fascinating and distressing to me to watch the executives in companies think that their company is more important if they're active in Washington. And the other side of that dynamic is for the Washington representation to essentially manufacture issues to justify their own activity in Washington and bolster the size of the lobbying shop. The spam issue was one that was pretty much manufactured. The idea that there is a public policy solution to spam is mistaken, and that's been proven out by the Canned Spam Act's dramatic failure. Spyware was another one. Frankly, net neutrality has that flavor as well, as being something that lobbyists are manufacturing to show the office back home that they're important, and that executives who don't understand this world think that it is important, that they have to be here in order to be relevant. So it's too bad, though it's quite
Jim,
natural to see Google going this route.
Jim, you know, this is Adam. I totally agree with that sentiment, and I've written extensively about that same public choice problem in the field of technology policy. And, you know, it goes back to what Milton Friedman called the business community's suicidal impulse to sometimes come to Washington and preach about markets and then do all sorts of misguided things that are anti-market. But the reality is, when we complain about these tech companies coming to Washington and creating lobbying shops, you know, the response I always get to that is, what are we supposed to do? I mean, there's a lot of pressure on to regulate things even if they don't come here. And moreover, a lot of older companies or industries already have very well-established shops here. I mean, do they have an alternative? I mean,
they tend to come here in a defensive stance, and that's appropriate to try to protect their ability to compete. But then after they successfully defend off something, the lobbying shop is there, and they have to justify themselves. So they go out and turn around and start going on offense. Let's create new issues for us to work on. Let's try to get competitive advantage through the regulatory process. And it's unfortunate to see, but I just don't know how to stop the process.
Right.
And that's one point I would make, too. I mean, Microsoft, when it came here, it was dragged here kicking and screaming. It had what I would say a healthy disdain for the sausage factory, you know, that we all know and love and loathe. But Google has offensive motives.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they favored net neutrality even before they had a DC office. But generally speaking, Hans, I mean, they, I think, were more anti-regulatory and more hands-off in general, besides their what I would regard misguided position on net neutrality to be. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sympathetic because I don't know what I would do if I was a tech baron and I was smart enough to actually invent technology instead of just talk about it on a podcast with you guys each week. I think I would probably send a few people to D.C. to cover my butt.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think if you look back at stuff I've written several articles in defense of Google in response to various proposals. I mean, there was a brief proposal out of the California legislature, I think, to regulate privacy in Gmail. And I forget one, I guess, and there's lots of copyright issues where, at least in my view, some entrenched interests are trying to use copyright law to stifle some of the things that Google's trying to do. So it really is a two-edged sword where I don't think it's reasonable to expect businesses to abstain from the political process altogether. I guess this is why I think the original Microsoft case was so troubling, because I think it really did, like that Post article said, it really did set the tone for the way the rest of the tech industry behaved. As long as most of the big players were staying out of Washington, none of them really had to invest these resources. But once, you know, Netscape and Sun came to the DOJ and sort of sicked the federal government of Microsoft, now you sort of start this process where now everybody needs a lobbying shop, and once some of them do, the rest have to in self-defense.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Cord Bloomquist, Jim Harper, Tim Lee, and Hans Haney for joining us. And if you'd like to read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something we said here on today's show, you can post a comment on our website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for today's show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, and please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.